From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. As a boy growing up in Austin, Texas, Rick Martinez recalls watching food television with his mother and seeing the likes of Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless speak with authority about the foods of Mexico. Deciding to connect with his roots, Rick now lives in Mazatlan and explores his cultural heritage in his cookbook, Mi Cocina, Recipes and Rapture from My Kitchen in Mexico. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. Congratulations on making the New York Times bestseller list.
I am over the moon. I cannot even believe it.
Yeah, I'm so happy for you. I would love you to talk a little bit about the impact that Diana Kennedy had on your young self. I know you admired her, but was it strange to see a British woman representing Mexico when you were a young boy in Austin, Texas?
It was really strange. I didn't really understand. She clearly had a knowledge that not many other people that were known in the United States had. Certainly, she was probably the most prominent voice of Mexican culture and cuisine, first above Rick Bayless, who also was an authority in Mexican culture and cuisine. But to a brown Mexican-American boy growing up in Texas, it seems strange to me that a British woman and a white man from Oklahoma were the authorities and were telling me about my culture and the cuisine. My mother and I would watch her show in particular, and there was an episode that she was making chorizo rojo y verde. I loved what she was doing, and she was going to the markets, and she was talking to the purveyors, and seeing these chorizos hanging in the mercados was so incredible to me. But I didn't understand why she got to do this. It seemed to me that there had to be a Mexican or a Mexican-American chef somewhere that could be explaining this. I respected her and I learned a lot from her, but I also had a resentment towards her because of that. And I decided as a teenager that I wanted to be that. I wanted to be her. I wanted to be the one to teach other people about Mexican cuisine and culture. I think there's so many amazing things that are happening both in Mexico and in the United States relative to Mexican and Mexican-American, Mexican immigrant cooks that I think those are the people that should be celebrated now.
Let's talk about this exploration of Mexico that you've done in this new book, Mi Cocina. I feel like it's been a way for you to really explore deeply your roots. So let's start in the capital with a dish that you love. Could you talk about the gazpacho morelliano?
Yes. It's such a beautiful dish. It's so strange because obviously, at least I had a very strong perception of what gazpacho is. And I think most people, at least in the United States, know what that is and have a very clear idea of that it's a Spanish soup. In this particular town, it is spelled with an S, not a Z, and it is basically a fruit salad. There's a street that probably has about 20 vendors on it, and each of the vendors sells their variation of this fruit salad, and it's typically made with mango, pineapple, and jicama. And these very young cooks with very sharp knives are very talented and are very quickly chopping this fruit into perfectly tiny little cubes. And they toss them together with lime juice and chili and put them in these tall glasses, top it with cheese and chamoy, crema, and more crushed chili. And then people around the streets just walk around eating this gazpacho. It's such a great accompaniment to grilled meats and fishes or anything that has sort of a charry flavor. It acts as a really great acidic and sweet counterpoint to a lot of foods.
I'm going to jump now to the mountains of Veracruz and a dish called uliche.
Yes, it's such a beautiful, comforting dish. I think that for a lot of fans of Mexican food, you probably are aware of mole. You might even be aware of mole poblano versus the moles in Oaxaca. But I think probably what you may not know is that a white mole or mole blanco exists, and it's called ulichi. And it's a really beautiful dish that the base is actually fresh chilies and corn masa. It's such a classic and important flavor combination in all of Mexican cuisine. But the fact that it exists in this beautiful velvety sauce, I think it's really incredible. And, you know, relative to some of the other more complex moles, it's a really easy mole to make. It's really beautiful. I've served it with roasted chilies and stewed chicken. To me, it reminded me almost of a chicken and dumplings. Chicken and dumplings are something that I grew up with in Texas that my mom made. And it's creamy, it's chickeny, it's a really beautiful cold weather comfort dish. And the ulichi really speaks to me in that same way. It's very comforting and very homey.
And now let's go for a minute to the Yucatan and relleno negro.
Ah. Oh. Wow, you're just pulling all of my favorites.
Oh, that's so nice.
The relleno negro, the first time I had had that, I had a friend who was a chef at a resort in the Yucatan. And I basically told him, definitely I want to eat your food, but what I would really like is I would really like to try some just taco stands out in the middle of nowhere that are much more homey. To me, that food is much more real, because the people that are making it because they love that food and they know that they're good at it. They're not making it to please a tourist. They're making it because of a genuine love and desire to make that food for other people. And so he took me down a highway and we stopped at this little taco stand, seemingly in the middle of nowhere. There was nothing else around. And I walked up and there was this bubbling tray of this black sauce. And I was just so intrigued. I'd never seen anything like that. It didn't look like a mole. It actually just looked, it almost looked like charcoal. Like it was that black. But the smell was incredible. I could smell the spices. I could smell the chiles. And then I could smell turkey. And I love turkey. Imagine Thanksgiving turkey, but with vegetables simmering in a soup and lots of chiles and spices. But then this like really interesting note of fire and char. And I was so intrigued, I had to have that. Even after I ate it and I absolutely loved this dish, I didn't understand how something that was so intensely black could be that flavorful and not bitter or acrid. And it is this really amazing process that the Mayans created to not only char, like, or incinerate the ingredients in this dish, but then to somehow remove all of those flavors, those really harsh flavors, and reconstitute those ingredients so that they again retain their original flavor, but with this really nice smoky flavor. It's an incredible dish and it's very striking. And I put it as a spread in the book because it is such a beautiful and unusual dish when you first come across it.
What role has immigration to Mexico played in the country's regional cuisines?
I think that were it not for the migration of people, whether they immigrated willingly or not, whether they were conquerors or they were escaping some harsh reality in their country of origin, those people created the cuisine of Mexico. Mexican cuisine is, I view it as layers. You have the indigenous people that were here before anybody else came. And then each wave of migration created this new layer of flavor that just kept building and building. I think tacos al pastor is a great example of that. You had Lebanese and Iraqi immigrants come into the country. They brought with them the technique of making shawarma. They brought with them the trompo or the spit. And Mexicans really like pork. And so they swapped out the meat and started using pork. They started integrating other indigenous flavors like the dried chilies, like the achiote. And then all of a sudden, you have this incredible fusion of cultures and flavors. And less than 100 years later, it is an iconic Mexican dish.
Well, it was such a pleasure to get to talk to you, Rick, about your new book, Mi Cocina. And once again, congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Rick Martinez. His cookbook is Mi Cocina, Recipes and Rapture from My Kitchen in Mexico. You'll find a link to one of his recipes on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, food workers join forces to form a more perfect union.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. 17 corporate Starbucks locations in the U.S. have unionized since the end of 2021. In April, employees of an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island voted to do the same. Although unions had been on the decline for decades, there seems to be a potential shift across multiple industries. What does this uptick in union organization mean for food and farm workers? Lisa Held reported on the galvanized movement for civil eats. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Evan.
Can we start with a discussion of why unions have declined so much in the last 70 years?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Union membership really is at a low point, even though there is all this momentum in the other direction. It's been declining really since the 1950s and has been particularly low among food workers. There's a lot of reasons for that. A lot of it has been policy driven, and there have been state laws and federal laws that have made it harder for employees to unionize, you know, made it easier for companies to retaliate against employees that choose to organize. And what we've seen is just rising income inequality over that time. The numbers are pretty crazy. The trend in terms of income inequality has gone up as union membership has gone down. And this is really the first time in a long time that we've kind of seen the trend starting to potentially turn the other way.
I would imagine that part of it is because so much of the union movement was based in manufacturing. And as manufacturing has declined in the U.S. and service jobs have increased, union membership probably didn't transfer.
It's a good point, especially when we're talking about food, because so many of these jobs are service jobs. Although some of the jobs are food production, which is a little bit closer to a manufacturing job. But actually, that is the sector of the food system that is the most unionized, even though it's still small. Meatpacking plants are more unionized than the service side.
What percentage of food workers formally belong to a union?
I think it's really difficult to quantify because we don't generally look at food workers even as a sector altogether. So we look at meatpacking workers, we look at farm workers, we look at restaurant workers, but it's hard to find statistics that combine all of them together. But it's very, very low. To give you an example, United Farm Workers has been organizing farm workers just in the state of California for a very long time. And even with the successes they've had, their union only represents less than 1% of farm workers in California.
Despite being in unions, when workers go up against these corporate giants, they still tend to get short shrift. How did the pandemic uncover inadequacies in unionized sectors of the industry?
Yeah, it's a great question because these meatpacking plants I'm talking about that are unionized had really terrible COVID-19 outbreaks. The unions will say, well, because they were there, they were able to step in quickly and fight for their workers to then get protection more quickly, and things kind of were corrected faster than they would have been if the union wasn't there. But it is true that there were a lot of illnesses and deaths at plants covered by UFCW. what they also told me is that workers still do see the union, even in places where these outbreaks happen. They still saw the value of having the union as opposed to not having it. And they actually increased their numbers of workers that were joining the union while all that was happening.
Do you think one of the ways that, for example, the Starbucks unions have been more successful in organizing is due to the employees' sophisticated use of social media to organize?
I think Starbucks does employ a lot of young people who are social media savvy, maybe people from more privileged backgrounds and that don't face some of the challenges we were talking about in terms of, say, farm workers, if they're migrants that are coming to this country and are undocumented or, you know, have language barriers. Seeing kind of those people, the Starbucks employees, thinking about how they can then help food workers in other sectors, like farm workers or meatpacking workers that maybe don't have some of the same advantages, and kind of work in solidarity across the food system. I think that a lot of people talked about that, and so it'll be interesting to see if we see more of that happening in the future.
So do you think that the recent Amazon unionizing in New York is going to inspire or nudge workers in the food sector to organize?
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of momentum from all sides. And, you know, one of the experts I interviewed who's been working in food labor for more than 20 years, he said momentum is at an all-time high among food workers. They're seeing what's happening just in every sector, and things just are getting going. And I think people realize what's possible.
Do you think if the pandemic is also driving the momentum as people reevaluate what they want and don't want from their jobs?
Definitely. And I think in terms of food workers, the pandemic really exposed a lot of challenges that food workers face in their jobs. And during the beginning stages of the pandemic, especially, everybody was calling food workers essential, right? And saying they're essential workers. Everybody else got to stay home and work at their computers. And food workers had to go to the meatpacking plants and keep working. They had to go to farms and keep picking the vegetables. And I think they realized, okay, well, everyone's saying we're essential and we have to keep working. Well, then why should we be facing these risks and, you know, putting ourselves in danger in this case or working for low wages when we are the ones that are kind of keeping everything going?
Voting for a union's just the beginning of the process, right? How long do contract negotiations typically take?
I'm not sure if there's an average amount of time. I know the very first farm worker union that was certified in New York State was certified in September of 2021. And they, when I interviewed some of the people working on that in March, they were still in negotiations with the vineyard that they were working at, getting their contract in place. So in that case, it was a span of several months.
Can you elaborate on the Farm Laborers Fair Labor Practice Act and just how laws in general need to change to protect workers' rights?
Yeah, so federal labor laws for a long time have left farm workers specifically out of some of the protections that other workers have. So the big ones are the right to organize, which is what we're talking about, and also the right to overtime pay. So because that is not guaranteed at the federal level, a lot of states have passed their own laws to put these kinds of policies in place.
It's kind of interesting to think about what the future of unions within the food industry might look like. It seems like if the sectors banded together within the supply chain, it could be enormously powerful.
Yeah, I think that to me is the most interesting aspect of this conversation. One of the things that one of my sources said to me is that unions are effective when they have density. And you don't really have power until you have density, a lot of people, right? And the food system is huge if you think about it in terms of all the way from the farm to the food that ends up on your plate. Where things get interesting is if those workers see themselves as part of the same system and are able to build that density across the food chain.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. What an interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lisa Held, a senior policy reporter for Civil Eats. To read her article on how the surge of union organizing is affecting food and farmers, you can visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Our journeys to a food-centered life are different. We all grow up in a food culture that's part of our parents and part the environment where we live. But then we leave home, our world enlarges, and we eat from that bigger world. The seeds of our new passion are within us, but often need a spark to ignite. For Suzanne Barr, it was returning home to care for her ailing mother. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so grateful you're able to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
How did your mom influence your experience of first food and eating and then food and cooking?
In so many ways. My earliest memories of my mom giving me kind of this confidence and understanding of food was her teaching me how to make a proper cup of tea. And it felt like a ritual to make it with her. That's turning the water on, getting the tea bag, warming the cup, placing the bag into the cup, pouring the water, having the right amount of tea bag color. The color needs to be just right before adding in milk. So while she was sick, that was the one thing left that she could still partake upon. As her cancer progressively got worse, it was less about food intake and was more about just getting her to drink some fluid. So the ritual of making tea was really this understanding of my mother and rituals and holding on to traditions.
What role did your mom play in inspiring you to go into the restaurant business?
That's a good one, because, you know, she passed away before I actually decided to go into the industry. But the one gift that I took from my time living back at home and being her caretaker was I needed to understand and connect to what her physical body was going through. Her organs were shutting down. She couldn't have the same taste, the same flavors and things. So her favorites, curry chicken and curry goat, were not her favorites anymore. And so eventually when she did pass away and I continued in my life, and it was a good 7 years before I started to question what I was doing with my life. My dad cooked and he wanted to open a patty shop and had dreams and aspirations. But this for me felt very different because I had a profession, I had a career.
When you made the decision to walk into chef life, you enrolled in a very particular culinary program. Can you tell us about it and why you made that choice?
I immediately started researching and came across this one school, the Natural Gourmet Institute. It was going to take me on a journey of understanding whole ingredients, whole balanced eating, and what that meant.
Your life is really interesting to me in that you have spent time in many different places, in particular, going back and forth between Canada and the States. Tell us a little bit about where you opened your two restaurants, Saturday Dinette and True True.
We drove to Canada in hopes of visiting and seeing a city that was exciting. And he proposed to me in Toronto the second night we were there. And due to immigration issues, we had to make a very hard decision after only knowing each other for 6 months. We were going to get married. We were going to move to a new country and we were going to open up our business together. That business was Saturday Dinette. And Saturday Dinette had always been planned to be a neighborhood corner restaurant that was going to just offer the classics, comforts. It had always been a diner, and we wanted to honor the history and the humble beginnings of what diners mean for communities. It wasn't a dream to open a restaurant, but it became a dream because of all of the connections that we made, all of the lessons, the hard lessons that we had to learn, all of the memories that we created for families. Pork chops with applesauce, meatloaf with mashed potato, corn grits with fried chicken, sweet potato latkes with gravlax that we were making in-house.
What happened to Saturday Dinette?
I think what happened to Saturday Dinette was what's happened to so many restaurants. The complexities and the systemic issues that we are seeing and we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, and what I struggled with the most with looking at how dysfunctional and how much control landlords have on businesses that are operating out of their own spaces. As time progressed, little small grievances shifted into larger, bigger grievances. They shifted into physical confrontations. Then it shifted into a legal police being called to then eventually just making a very hard decision. Is your mental well-being worth it to continue to operate under the conditions and the forced behavior from your landlords?
I know that you were asked to come into a failing business and consult, but soon thereafter became a partner in a new endeavor, which would become True True. And it was really affected by the pandemic and these partners pivoting and deciding that they no longer wanted to be in the restaurant business.
The pandemic has allowed us to reimagine our lives not working together. Being married and being business partners has its ups and downs. We just both wanted to do different things. I've completed my first book. I am freelance writing for a publication in Canada as a recipe developer, which has been a dream. What specifically also brought me to South Florida is an opportunity to consult on another restaurant. I leaped at it because it is quite different from anything I've done before.
Well, I really loved your book, My Aki Tree. As I read, I was both moved and encouraged by your willingness to reveal the difficult life decisions and details that are more personal and not often discussed openly. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
That's Chef Suzanne Barr, author, restaurateur, and social advocate. Her new book is My Aki Tree, a chef's memoir of finding home in the kitchen. In a minute, we remember a pillar of LA's Chinatown. That's next, when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Last week, Los Angeles lost a titan of the Chinatown community. Lupe Liang, the co-founder and owner of beloved restaurant Hapu, passed away at the age of 61. To share his legacy and the impact he made on his community, as well as our local food scene, we invited a longtime friend of Good Food to come speak with us, Eddie Lin. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Evan. Very nice to be back.
It's lovely to have you here. I wish it was under different circumstances.
Yeah, same here.
Lupe was co-founder of Hapu in Chinatown. How long ago did he start the restaurant, and what were his goals?
He purchased the restaurant back in 1993, and it was a small hole-in-the-wall, 8 seats. He really just wanted to expand and grow the restaurant and to be a part of the community, because prior to that, he was working in the San Gabriel Valley before he got the restaurant. And before he was in the San Gabriel Valley, he actually immigrated from Mexico.
Tell us about his time in Mexico. Was he born there?
No, he actually was born in a little village in Guangdong, China. He came from a large family, and they farmed all kinds of vegetables, rice, wheat, peanuts, beans, yucca, taro, I mean, all kinds of stuff. As well as being a farming family, they were a family of cooks. So in 1978, he moved from Hong Kong, which was where he lived at the time, to join his brother in Rosarito Beach, Mexico, where his brother had a restaurant.
How was this time in Mexico reflected on the Hapu menu?
He's actually pretty famous for his trilingual menu, Chinese, English, and Spanish. This was a very deliberate thing he did because he noticed a lot of his competition in Chinatown, the menus were in Chinese. You were lucky if they were English. So adding the Spanish to his menu not only help clarify things if you were a Spanish speaker, but it was a signal that welcomed more of the community.
Was this also around the same time that he changed his name or added the nickname?
Well, he actually adopted Lupe. He gave himself the name while he was in Mexico, just because he was living there and he wanted to be a part of the country and his community.
How did the menu at Hapu differ from a typical Chinese restaurant? What made it distinctively Angeleno?
Going back to his roots in Mexico, he did throw in jalapenos here and there. He also brought over a really interesting holiday item. During Thanksgiving and Christmas, he introduced to Chinatown the Chinese turkey. Well, his Chinese turkey had roots in Tijuana. And in Tijuana, I'm not sure if a lot of people know this, but there's something called Mexican Thanksgiving. He brought that over when he opened Hap Wu. The Chinese turkey that he sells is actually from TJ, and the recipe and everything, nothing's changed. He's also known for his exotic secret menu. Actually, maybe not so secret, because some of those items were on his chef special. Had your show Good Food cover some of his aphrodisiac items like pizzle soup, aka beef penis soup, for Valentine's Day. He had 7 courses of boa constrictor. He's had goose intestines, lamb fries or lamb testicles, all kinds of pretty adventurous stuff.
What are some of the go-tos that you've enjoyed over the years at Hap Wu?
The wonton noodle soup with beef stew and tendon. And so it was just this really homey, very simple item that was my kind of connection to my childhood in Chinatown.
The restaurant is a family affair. Who survives Lupe?
His lovely wife, Judy. She was just a constant in the front of the house with her elegant qipao, Chinese gown. She has been running it since Lupe passed and when he was ill as well. She's been the face of the restaurant for a while.
How did his daughters help modernize the menu?
His daughters took over, especially Mary, I believe, the older daughter. She definitely took over the social. I noticed the social media was much more active when she took charge. She handled a book about Hapu. I think it was kind of a cookbook that she arranged.
There are 2 Hapus, one in downtown L.A., and there's one in West L.A. Are they connected to one another?
The one on Olympic in West L.A. was formerly owned by Lupe and Judy, and they sold it because they just couldn't handle that much work and just decided to run the Chinatown store.
Does the family intend to keep the restaurant going?
Lupe expressed to me a few years back that he was interested in selling. I didn't know anything about his health at the time. I'm not sure if that had anything to do with it. But since his passing, Judy and the family have expressed more urgent desires to sell.
So sad. A whole era is coming to a close. And he was so deeply loved by the chef community.
It's really a loss. He also was very important to the revitalization of Chinatown with the Chinatown Summer Nights events and the moon festivals. And he definitely represented the more traditional aspects, the traditional restaurants of Chinatown, alongside the newer generation of restaurants that have come in lately.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Eddie, for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts about Lupe with us.
Yeah, he's a huge loss for the community. Thank you, though, for letting me share his life.
That was Eddie Lin speaking about the legacy of Hap Wu founder Yenning Lupe Liang. We featured him in his restaurant in an In the Weeds segment from 2020. His family has also set up a GoFundMe page to help with funeral costs. You can find links to both of those on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. More than a third of the world's population uses chopsticks on a daily basis. Like other single-use products, such as straws, that's a major environmental concern. Roughly 80 billion wooden chopsticks find their way into landfills annually. Felix's book found he was sitting on a solution for using the discarded utensils. That idea became a company, Chop Value.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
What was the light bulb moment that you got to repurpose used chopsticks?
I totally get it. It's probably not one of these things that, you know, you grew up thinking one day I want to recycle chopsticks for a living. So to me, that light bulb moment actually happened at sushi dinner with my girlfriend, now wife. Being a wood engineer by trade, I was always looking for solutions, how I can have an impact that actually is super easy, understandable by everyone around me. And that's how I looked at these little chopsticks and thought maybe that's where I can start.
What is a wood engineer?
I'm coming from the woodworking background in the trades. And then as a young carpenter, I thought, how can I add to my education in academia? And it's pretty much a mechanical engineering degree that focuses on timber and other wood resources as a raw material. And that's wood engineering to me.
Wow. So describe how Chop Value gives these discarded chopsticks a second life.
You know, it's one of these little resources that I think are just neglected and underutilized. So I thought, what if I could create a process in a very efficient way? We call it a microfactory, and can turn these chopsticks into a new end product, and everyone understands what a viable circular economy means. So if I were to run you through the process, you have to picture that we are picking up 350,000 chopsticks every single week. They are coming into the gate in our microfactory. They have to get sorted all into the same direction. Then they're going into a water-based resin bath. That resin is developed from the automotive industry. Then they're getting dried. And then they enter this really, really dense hydraulic hot press. And that creates this new uniform engineered raw material, which is our basic modular tile, which we're using for all of our beautiful end products. That's the process.
Is it similar to when we see, let's say, a butcher block, where we see the end grain and we see all the pieces of wood that have been jammed together? Is it a similar process?
It's similar, only kind of the other way around. So when you see kind of on a butcher block the end grain, someone has vertically put the pieces upwards so that you can actually see the wood. We are creating flat pieces first. And then these flat pieces can obviously be used to be laminated together again into new products.
It's hard for me to wrap my brain around the fact that they have to all be put into the same direction. Does that happen mechanically?
No, it used to. The first weeks when we started collecting and we realized there are thousands of chopsticks that we are actually able to gather. Yes, we started by hand because we couldn't believe it. And then we developed our own machinery to really, really find an efficient way to automate the process to make sure that we're actually creating a viable business.
So you're based in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you get the word out to begin collecting?
How we started the collection program was really going from restaurant to restaurant and asking them to participate in our urban harvesting program. So we thought if we were to able to convince restaurants to be part of a community of like-minded people who want to have a small step towards environmental impact, we thought this is how we could start real change. We placed our bins in all these restaurants and we are picking up these chopsticks once a week.
Approximately how many restaurants do you have participating just in Vancouver?
So just in Vancouver, we have more than 500 partners now. So pre-pandemic, we had around 100 partners to get to our volume of running a successful business. Now we have more than 450 to 500 partners as part of the program.
Now, you call it a microfactory. Does that mean it's a footprint that can be pretty much easily set up anywhere?
Yeah, that's the idea. So our intention is that we actually develop these microfactories in a way that they're very low noise level and can fit into any existing footprint in an existing warehouse or light industrial space, very close to the resource. Because when you look at creating new sustainable products, we really want to keep shipping in mind because shipping is a huge impact for the carbon footprint. So the closer we can actually be with our manufacturing process to the end consumer, the better it is for the environment.
What woods are the chopsticks that you're collecting generally made from?
In North America, around 90 to 95% are actually bamboo. When you're going over to Japan, for instance, that percentage changes. And I think over half of the volume of chopsticks are actually made out of different softwood species. And that's just based on who are the closest trading partners, where disposable materials are coming from. And that just happens to be North America, that most of our disposables are actually imported from Asia.
So what furniture or value-added products are you able to make from this new compressed material?
I like how you're saying this. This like compressed, highly densified material where we had to be creative in what niche application can we actually add most of the value to a circular economy. So we started off with small home decor items, wall decor sets, wall features, coasters that we customize for our customers. But it's really now a wide range of sustainable home decor, furniture, and even large work-from-home solutions for our corporate clients. So a really wide range that we're producing in our microfactories from coast to coast.
So I went on the website and I saw different kinds of boards, like charcuterie boards, cheese boards, to chopping boards. Then I also saw desks that looks like the stand is made from metal, and then you have a top made from your material that just sets in. What's the most popular?
To date, it's probably still, by volume, it's the coaster. I think it's such a beautiful storytelling piece alongside with the phone holder. By quantity, you know, especially now moving through this pandemic world where we're really helping to bring these sustainable products into the work and learn from home environment. So we've sold hundreds of desks just the last few months.
How many chopsticks have you acquired since Chop Value's conception?
I think we have now more than 55 million chopsticks that we actually recycled and transformed into new products.
So I have to ask, do you make chopsticks?
We don't. We're not making chopsticks out of chopsticks. If you're on the journey of actually creating a viable business out of something that you're recycling or and collecting, I strongly believe that you have to create a certain value in the design process and the engineering process into the product that you're turning that material into. Meaning, creating chopsticks out of recycled chopsticks doesn't make much sense, because then you would need to sell them for more than the new chopsticks, and that would obviously not be a viable business.
Are you looking for people to join you, perhaps in like a franchise model, to acquire these mini factories?
Yeah, I mean, we are very excited that we have already so many amazing partners all around the world that are opening microfactories with us. And we're definitely looking now to expand this model to California, to Texas, to Washington and Oregon, to Florida and to New York. When I'm thinking about the U.S., we are fortunate to expand it from coast to coast in Canada already.
Thank you so much, Felix.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Felix Book, founder of Chop Value. To see a video on how his company is using chopsticks to create items for everyday living, or to purchase these wares, visit chopvalue.com. Only in Los Angeles, or perhaps the Twilight Zone, would someone direct you to a sushi restaurant shaped like a chili bowl. Enthusiasts flocked to Shunji on Pico Boulevard for 8 years before Shunji Nikau went west to Ocean Boulevard in Santa Monica. Los Angeles Times restaurant critic Bill Addison is here to discuss the new digs and what's on the menu. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
So how long has Shunji Nikau contributed to the Los Angeles sushi scene?
I would call him one of the quiet architects behind what we now know as LA sushi culture. He arrived from Japan, from Yokohama, a city 20 miles south of Tokyo, in 1984. And he was one of the original chefs at Matsuhisa, the defining Nobu restaurant of the 80s. He and his brother Tetsuya both worked there. And then they left in the early 1990s to open Asanebo in Studio City, which I feel like is one of the most beloved sushi and Japanese restaurant institutions in Los Angeles. Nikau was there at Asanebo until 2000. And then he worked at other restaurants. He went back to Tokyo for a while. And finally, in 2012, he moved into that crazy chili bowl location that, as you said, really was at the intersection of Sawtelle and the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Before Shunji, it was Mr. Cecil's California Ribs.
Yeah. I mean, you had to have seen this building to believe it, but it was shaped like a crock. And it was part of a short-lived restaurant chain called the Chili Bowl that started in the 30s. And the building it moved at one point, and it was home to a Mexican restaurant and a toy shop and a real estate agency. It's just one of these very only in Southern California locations.
Let's talk about his food. Describe eating at the original Shunji and then compare it with his new space.
Sure. The original Shunji was ambitious in every way. There were several a la carte options. There were omakase options and multiple price tiers. And he had all these elaborate vegetable small bites that were woven in among cooked seafood courses, as well as the procession of nigiri and rolls that define omakase. In the new space, everything is much more understated in the best sort of way. I asked Shunji at a recent meal at Shunji 2.0 how he felt different, and he said he felt like the place before the chili bowl got too big. It had an 8-seat counter, but also 7 tables, so it was a lot. This place is much more streamlined. 2 counters, one where Nikau serves and the other where his longtime chef, Miki Nakahiro, serves, 7 seats apiece.
Oh, that's such an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, it is interesting. And you have to reserve one or the other. It's not cheap. He has focused the price down to $250 per person for an omakase. That's it. Your only options really are the drinks you choose. That's not quite as expensive in LA's sushi stratum as a place like Morihiro in Atwater Village, or definitely Sushi Ginza Onadira in West Hollywood, where it's like $400 a person.
So what were some of the standouts from your meals at Shunji 2.0? And can you talk about the rice?
Yes, it's always fun to talk about the rice. So first we start with some of the prepared dishes. I noticed more of that sense of the vegetable bites that I talked about. Those are largely gone, and it's more composed plates, really beautiful, striking compositions is the best word for it. Tiny fried ice fish over pureed spring cabbage that's as smooth as applesauce, but still very much tasting beautifully of fresh spring cabbage. Translucent, slippery baby eels. I'm not sure I'd ever had those before, in dashi topped with grated mountain yam, which has that very specific gently sticky texture. So it was really a study in interesting textures. There's so much sushi in Los Angeles now that it's as interesting to think about the rice as it is about the fish. And the rice at Shunji is a little cooler than some of the other places, a little less nutty perhaps, but still really satisfying.
Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
Bill Addison is the LA Times restaurant critic. He joined us to talk about Shunji and its new location on Ocean Boulevard in Santa Monica. To find his recommendations where to eat and what to order, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, what happens when a carb-loving chef and a produce forager get their hands on some fresh spring peas? I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims for the Market Report. I'm standing in the back of a refrigerated truck in the parking lot in front of a restaurant, Antico Nuevo, on the border of Koreatown and Larchmont, speaking with Dragan Ivanovich. Dragan, good morning. How are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Can you explain to me what the situation is? You have a lot of boxes of farmers market produce kind of lying around. I'm seeing green tomatoes, I'm seeing garlic, I'm seeing peas and Meyer lemons. Can you kind of explain why you have all this fruit in the back of your truck right now?
Well, we have Chef Chad next to me, and then he's about to start doing his shopping. So what I do, I freshly forage all California stuff, and I bring it to the restaurants. Chefs have first pick. They come in, they taste their stuff, and that's pretty much it.
What farms and markets do you go to kind of pick up everything that you're bringing to chefs down here?
So I usually do, I do once a week at the moment, pick up from San Francisco. I leave Friday afternoon. I drive all the way to Sacramento, which I pick up a lot of Sacramento asparagus. I do a lot of cherries from the area, from Gotelli Farm. And also I pick up a lot of stuff from Brentwood area. Chef Chad knows soon we'll be getting some Brentwood corn and some pole beans. She's been asking me about it, so I've been telling you. So it's about probably 3 to 4 weeks out. So on my way down, I stop by to Ferry Plaza, go to a Mountain View Farmers Market, Palo Alto. I hit up Watsonville, Hollister, Paso Robles. So it's a lot of pickups, you know, but it's worth it.
And how often do you do these pickups and bring them down to Los Angeles?
So once a week, we'll do Friday all the way through Sunday night. And then we also pick up at a local around here, Los Angeles County and Santa Barbara County. That's probably like, you know, three times a week when we have a truck to go pick up stuff there as well.
Tell me how you got started in this operation. What was the inspiration that you started going to pick up produce and bringing it to chefs down here?
Well, I grew up back home in Belgrade. So my grandma, she had a plantation, a big a raspberry farm. And she would like, you know, actually, we would harvest the raspberries throughout the summertime. So I was always surrounded about the good quality stuff and always eating the good stuff. When I came here about 20 years ago, I kind of saw like the small farms need to be more supported, and chefs would like wanted to get their best stuff possible. So I kind of grew up around it.
What are some of your favorite fruits and vegetables that you picked up that you tried along the way that you were like, these are the best that I can remember that off the top of my head?
So this is a really nice time of the year. I like this time because there's a lot of storm fruits coming up. I'm kind of into storm fruits. Also berries are really good. And then we'll have some nice melons are coming up, cucumbers. My favorites are tomatoes. Tomato season is coming up as well. So this is actually like the best time of the year, I would say, like, you know, where you can get the most variety.
And I know today Chef Colby is going to be talking about how he makes English peas. So tell me about the English peas that you've brought here today.
He's been getting some peas from Tutti Frutti Farm. He's been using those for many, many years. So he kind of knows what he wants. And he tells me, like, Dragan, I need peas from Tutti Frutti. And also I can add to that, sometimes when peas are like scarce in this area, which we're coming to the summer, and peas will kind of fade in Southern California, the new crop will start in Northern California, which I will get it from Jacopi Farm, Half Moon Bay, which their season starts like, you know, about month to month and a half later.
Thank you so much, Dragan.
You got it, man.
That was Dragan Ivanovich, specialty produce curator and market forager. I'm here with Chef Chad Colby, chef proprietor of Antico Nuevo Restaurant. Good morning, Chad. How are you doing?
Good morning.
So, Chad, we are also standing in the truck here with Dragan, looking at all his amazing produce, and know that he's brought you some beautiful English peas. Can you tell me about what you're planning to do with them?
I will just defer to Dragan on which peas are the best in the moment. He works with a lot of farms that I've known for a long time. And when I go to the markets, I like to taste and not pre-order. I get that connection and that trust with Dragan of getting which ones are the sweetest and not too starchy. We're doing a pasta, a ravioli, as peas and mint. And it's really straightforward and really just showcasing the quality of our ingredients and our techniques, and everything else is transparent. So if the peas aren't good, there's not enough technique or other ingredients to mask that. It's really about treating the ingredients as simple as possible. I want the peas to taste the most expression of a sweet pea as possible.
Can you tell me about the rest of the produce? I know you said you get a large amount of your produce from Dragan for Antico. Tell me about like everything that you like to use and different ways you like to use it in the restaurant.
Well, with intention, any dish that really focuses a vegetable or is a main component we'll make sure that we get of farmer's market quality and through Dragon. The menu has some stability in and around the proteins and some of the prepared starches, the pastas. And really, it's not a daily revolution. It's an evolution of the menu through the vegetable seasonality. So I want people to eat the steak year-round, eat the chicken year-round, but then get the different contorni vegetables that are fresh right off the truck.
Tell me how your relationship with Dragon, bringing you produce, how that started.
I worked over a decade with Nancy Silverton from Moza back to Campanile. We did weekly drop-offs, pickups with Dragon. There's a real luxury for a chef to get to have access to all this product, have it come in the middle of the day. Here we have one of the best farms at Santa Monica, JJ Lone Daughter. I think her stuff's phenomenal. I get the best of the farmer's market, the local markets. It's interesting. I've visited a lot of the farms. A lot of the farms at the local markets are upwards of 5 hours away from Los Angeles. So I don't find there to be like a non-local element to using California produce from up north. And as someone that's filtering Italian food, I use a lot of Italian products. And so I'd rather take the best of what we have in the States. And so if English peas are better in Half Moon Bay than they are on our doorstep, I want the Half Moon Bay ones. There's a lot of trust of the sourcing. There are multiple drops per week that Dragon will accommodate, and we can kind of see how things are selling on the menu. I think we've really seen a big increase in volume of product, that things are getting back to normal. Indoor dining is really coming back full circle and feeling normal again.
That's exciting. Thank you so much, Chad.
Thank you.
That was Chad Colby, chef proprietor of Antico Nuovo Restaurant. For the Market Report, this is Ben Mims.
Starting next week, Good Food is moving to a new time. You'll hear the show an hour earlier on Saturdays at 10 a.m. right after Life Examined and before the treatment. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laryl Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. If your experience with green peas is limited to the supermarket freezer section, and no shade if it is, I urge you, head to the farmer's market and get yourself some fresh ones. They're incredible on their own in a salad, and they're also delicious in an Italian spring vegetable stew called vignarola or a risotto. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.